Hey guys. Happy Monday morning to you. How are you doing? I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Also, cop hatred. That is to say, news coverage of police activity. Same thing. But mostly it's about the wars. Lots and lots of wars. You know, maybe I should have called Ray. Talk about Iraq. Yeah, I guess maybe I will. Let's see. Get Ray 4-1. Alright, so today on the show, our good friend Gareth Porter is going to be here. Well, look, he wrote an article. You think that he should write an article and that I should neglect the opportunity to interview him about a thing that he wrote? That's crazy. Of course he's going to be on the show today. He wrote an article. What more is there to say? Oh, I know. It's about Syria. All right. So, Gareth Porter coming up. Also, Jacob Hornberger is going to come on to oppose World War II. Oh, no. Everybody loves World War II. You have to love World War II. World War II was the best war ever. And if you don't think so, then why do you hate freedom and baby Jesus so much? You obvious Nazi simp. Well, Jacob Hornberger's got a little bit different point of view on the good war. World War II. I like how he sent out in the email this morning all awesome World War II articles. Him and Bob Higgs and quite a few others. His is from 1991. Like, yeah, just send this one back out. And it's solid. That Hornberger, man, he's been good on this stuff for a long, long time. It's hard to get Americans to question their religious belief in America's sacrifice in World War II. But I think if you're willing to question it, you have lots of questions. Hornberger's going to address some of those today. Because it's Memorial Day. If you're like me, then you puked this morning watching Barack Obama give his stupid freaking speech. Okay, not literally, but figuratively, and that's bad enough. I mean, the speech was literal. The puking was figurative. Make sure we get our verb tenses correct here. But anyway, you know, sentimentality doesn't really impress me even when it's legit. But a politician trying to wax all sentimental about the people that he got killed for nothing? Joey, all he wanted to do was be a park ranger and to help protect the land in his near his home that was so important to him and his family and his friends and his people. I got him killed in Afghanistan for nothing. He died for nothing. And so, what a heroic sacrifice. Okay, next. Billy, he got killed in Iraq, fighting for the Bada Brigade in their temporary victory over Al-Qaeda in Iraq. All he wanted to do was raise his kids and love his wife and go to work and live a good, honest, hard-working life. He was the best of us, Billy was. Billy, he was really something. Well, he could have been, but we got him killed in a war for the Bada Brigade. It was a great speech. Really touched my heart. Crocodile tears. Who made up that? What does that mean? What's the etymology of crocodile tears? Is it because they can't cry? And so that's the point. It's a politician badly acting, unable to summon the fake tears necessary to make us believe that he really cares at all. You know, Memorial Day, it should be called Cognitive Dissonance Day. Right? Let's just lay it all bare. None of these wars are legit. None of these politicians who get us into these wars are legitimate. So how could their wars possibly be legitimate? We all already know this. Somehow, serving in the military is completely sanctimoniously justified anyway. Just from the sacrifices that have come before. It doesn't matter if George W. Bush and Barack Obama are the lowest scum of the earth. It doesn't matter if they're the worst liars of the millennium. If they're blood-soaked killers who have no freaking idea what they're doing. And if they do, then get a rope. If it's all deliberate what they've done, what they continue to do. Well, not Junior so much. He's painting pictures and hanging out. But you know what I mean. But somehow, hey, it's still serving your country, even when you know that, no, it's not. It's just serving the Emergency Committee for Israel. It's serving Lockheed. It's serving the Democratic Party. It's serving the interests of a bunch of generals in the Pentagon who want an even fatter pension than the one they're already taking out of your check. The entire empire is pure exploitation. Look, Ike Eisenhower, who supposedly won World War II by himself and was the Republican president of this country for 8 years, former Supreme Allied Commander of the United Nations Allies fighting World War II against the Nazis, he said, hey, be real careful that everybody who's making money off of all this militarization don't permanently alter the form of our civilization, of our society, into one where we all are bent toward killing instead of doing what we otherwise might do. Like the people whose lives were uselessly sacrificed that Obama mentioned in his speech today. Don't you see? I just saw one where a lady had a stillbirth and they prosecuted her for it. Did you see that? And somebody, that's a real thing. Can you believe that? These Republicans. And this lady tweeted, we have just criminalized stillbirths? What? And I says, no, I didn't tweet because I held my tongue. But I wanted to say, yeah, except for the part where we did. Because no, we didn't. The government is not you. It's not part of you. It's your enemy. It hates you. It's trying to kill you. So stop identifying yourself with it. We did this and that. You didn't. You're the one sitting here next to me with your jaw on the floor complaining about it. You can't believe it, but it's true, and you know it. The country, the land, the 300 million of us, the space here, the relationships between us all, that's not the government. That's not the nation. That's not the military and the CIA and the all the stupid marble statues in Washington, D.C., like it's Rome up there. You're you and I'm me and they're them. Your enemy, the state. And, you know, hell, if you've been paying attention to the news at all for the last couple of weeks, you see all these articles about soldiers crying about their sacrifices in the battle for Ramadi, the battles for Ramadi. And what was it that they were fighting for? To secure that land from the Iraqi people? From the people of Ramadi? You know, we fought to take the power away from them, and now they've taken it back, and it just breaks our heart. And now, you know, I don't know exactly what degree of popular support the Islamic State has in ISIS, but more than the Americans ever, I mean, in Ramadi. But it's more than the Americans ever had, and you know that that's true. Did you ever ask why you were fighting for Ramadi then? Before your buddy got shot for it?
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show here.
I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show.
You can see why I named it that. Anyway, check it out. Mudshark's in the chat room. He says, happy Stockholm Syndrome Day. Yep. How about happy No Better But Do It Anyway Day? Something. Nah, I guess Stockholm Syndrome's better. Anyway, join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. Hang out with Mudshark and them, man. God dang, it's like we're living in the past, only it's the future. scotthorton.org/chat. Plain old browser window, don't need any external applications or whatever. If you like using external applications and you know what it means when I say it's an IRC free node chat room, then apply those truths and then use hashtag Scott Horton Show. And you'll be in there with the guys. And hey to everybody, too. I didn't mean to exclude you guys. It's just, you know. I love Mudshark since way back. All right, so this is my show. Hey, I'm going to say a bunch of things here in a minute. But before I say those things, I'm going to say this. Guess what? We're going to do a thing that's going to be a raffle where you can win a vacation to Costa Rica. And it's not some FS job, some scam, you know, Caribbean cruise in your email crap or something like that. It's a guy who is a friend of the show. You may remember. I did an interview with him. His name's Joshua, and I forget his last name all of a sudden because that's not his last name isn't included on his Skype handle where I've been talking to him. What was it? Joshua something. Sorry. Anyway, man, he's got a farm. It's like some kind of farm slash vacation thing, like a hotel resort in the jungle in Costa Rica. I told the wife this, and she says, I want to go. But the deal is, we're not going. You're going. And what we're going to do is we're going to do raffle tickets. You got to fly yourself there. But you get a week, you and your girl or your guy or whatever you do, your kid, whoever, the second person you decide to bring, your best friend. Your second best friend. You and a guest get a week of a place to stay, your own private room, and plenty of food to eat and cool stuff to do. And, you know, and hang around with monkeys and stuff. Does that sound like a good thing? I mean, to me, the point is I want to make money by selling raffle tickets to you. And that's why he's doing this. It's his way of donating to the show. How can we raise some money? For the rent, for the electricity, for some new cables. New fan for Scott's PC. How are we going to do it? I know. And he came to me. It was his idea. Isn't that cool? He just came to me and said, hey, how about we do a raffle for a vacation down in Costa Rica? So, hey, chat room guys, what do you think of that? Would you pay money for a raffle ticket for a vacation down to Costa Rica and help support the show? Let me know if you think that's a good idea. Also, you people, if you're not chat room types, because you just don't like chat rooms, because that's not how you do business, then that's cool. How about send me a tweet about it? I mean, I'll have more details for you later, but it sounds to me like a good deal. And he said he did it one time before, and apparently it was quite successful. So, what do you guys think? Cool. Well, all right, good. So that's that. All right, now, I guess I'm not going to have time to do cop stuff. No, I have to. So the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that cops have qualified immunity, sovereign immunity, like Charles I. They are the law, and so the law cannot be made to apply to them. And the case, what it was a mentally ill lady with a knife who someone had called the cops to come and help her, of course. And apparently, they initially backed off. But then they went ahead and escalated it anyway and came at her and then shot her. And she's suing them. She lived. And they shot her a bunch of times, too. But she somehow survived and sued them. And the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was Scalia and I think Kagan or... It was Kagan or Sotomayor, I forgot. One of the new ladies on there that voted with Scalia against it. But the other seven justices said, cops can do whatever they want. They can shoot whoever they want. They can do whatever they want. The law does not apply to them because they have qualified immunity. And in the news article I read about this, they pointed out, even in just the straight news story, that this law has never been passed by any legislature. The judges have just made this up. That the cops can do whatever they want. The prosecutor and the judge and the cops can all conspire together to frame you. If they want to. And they cannot be prosecuted. So, I mean, what the hell are you going to do now? Here you got a whole new black civil rights movement and an anti-police brutality movement beyond that. Nationwide right now. Heating up right now. And you have the U.S. Supreme Court with the ultimate slap down. The police are not just citizens like you. The law does not apply to them. They own you. They are dukes and princes, and you are their serf. You are their property. And no matter what they do to you, they will never, ever, ever be held accountable. And not just because it's really hard to get a prosecutor to prosecute him, but because, no, the judges say you can't. The judges will stop the prosecutions. And now they can cite the U.S. Supreme Court in order to do so. Qualified immunity. Oh, yeah, you're free. I love watching the tear roll out of your eyes as you sing Land of the Free and Home of the Brave at the ball game. Yeah, you're free to go to the ball game. Sorta. I mean, better not have a glass bottle, and you better stop by the metal detector first and maybe let them frisk you. But you're free to sing a song about how free you are. This field is free of mice. You're that kind of free. You are free of mice. You're about as brave as a mouse. And then get this. Remember in Ohio where the guy's car backfired. He's with his girlfriend. His car backfired. And all these cops tore out after him chasing him. So he took off afraid for his life. They chased him far out of their jurisdictions across all different city and county lines where they were not supposed to be. They finally cornered him. They fired 137 shots into this guy's car. And they knew, the cops knew from the beginning, before they started chasing him, that his car was backfiring. It had backfired two or three times already. And they recognized it for what it was. But then, what, on the fourth one, one of these apes yelled gunshot? And they all just said, yes, license to kill. Come on, guys, we'll all pretend it's self-defense. Let's get him. They fired 137 shots, and then get this, only one cop was charged. One of the 20-something cops who fired was charged. And why? Because after it was over, after all the other cops had stopped, he ran and jumped up on the hood. You know they had stopped, or else what the hell was he doing running into the line of fire? He ran, jumped on the hood, fired 15 more shots, finishing them both off. He was charged. He was just acquitted by a jury of 12. Probably more than half of whom were government employees themselves.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next one is June 13th in Denver. It's just $5 if you sign up now at taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott. I got Jacob Hornberger on the line. He's the founder and the president of the Future Freedom Foundation. And today at the Future Freedom Foundation, that's fff.org, they're featuring all World War II articles today. So Jacob's article is called The Much Coveted World War II. I like that title. That's interesting. But then Richard Ebling, The Causes and Consequences of World War II, The Consequences of World War II by Sheldon Richman, World War II and the Military-Industrial Congressional Complex by Robert Higgs, the great Robert Higgs. And then even more, Was the Good War Unnecessary? That's, I believe, Anthony Gregory's review of Pat Buchanan's book, Churchill, and more, got an article about the internment of the Japanese American citizens here, too. So great stuff there today for Memorial Day. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Jacob?
Hey, fine. It's nice to be back, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Very, very happy to have you here. What exactly do you mean by the much coveted World War II?
Well, this is the war, you know, as you well know, is called the Good War. It's the war that the interventionists always fall back on, that when you point out that 58,000 plus American soldiers died in Vietnam for nothing, and they were sacrificed in a civil war in Korea as well, and you've got them involved in all kinds of foreign interventions that have turned out to be fiascos, they always go back to World War II and they say, but what about World War II? So it's the war they covet. It's their protective device. It's one that they fall back on and say, well, if it hadn't been for World War II, we'd all be speaking German today.
Mm-hmm. You know,
that's what I mean by much coveted, that they really covet it because it's the only war that even they pretend makes their case.
Right. And, you know, it's funny because I guess to me anyway, I don't usually hear that term very often except, you know, in the context of the commandments, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife and that kind of thing, which is a big motivation of war a lot of times, right? Coveting what your neighbor's got, that kind of thing. But then also, World War II, it turns out, as you're using the term here, World War II is the one that is always carved out as the exception to God's rule that thou shalt not kill. And you're right, they don't invoke Vietnam or Korea. It's always World War II. And so, you know, I definitely learned when I was a little kid that, you know, yeah, you're never, ever supposed to kill anyone ever, you know, other than immediate self-defense kind of situation. Unless you're wearing green and you're serving the flag and the eagle and Uncle Sam, in which case, like that one time when they stopped Hitler, then that means it's okay to kill whoever they say to kill because now they're the authority, more or less saying they're the substitute for God's will, the democratic will of the nation. And after all, Jacob, how in the hell can you second guess the democratic decision of the American people to take war to the Japanese imperialists and Hitler's Nazi Germans back then, when they're the definition of evil and aggressive, you know, action on Earth? They had to be stopped, and we're the goodest guys ever, the best ones to do the stopping. Why not?
Yeah, you make some interesting points. I mean, there's this sense that, if I've long argued, that many Americans have just elevated the federal government to the level of a god. So the Christians have two gods. One, the real God, and then side by side with the real God in partnership with him is the federal government. And that's why the welfare state, for example, they're involved in coveting and stealing what doesn't belong to them, taking money from those to whom it does belong and give it to others. People say, oh, that's not stealing at all. That's our federal God that's doing this. How can it be stealing if it's the government doing it? And it really wasn't a democratic decision to get involved in World War II. And in fact, it was the exact opposite. The American people, after the horrors of World War I and the total waste of American life in World War I, were almost, not unanimously, but predominantly opposed to getting involved in the European war. Even after England and France declared war on Germany, the overwhelming sentiment was, stay out of this war, don't do it again. And it was Roosevelt that said, no, I know better. And he lied to the American people in his 1940 campaign. He said, I'll never send your boys into another foreign war. And he was lying. He was trying to provoke the Germans into attacking so that he could say, we've been attacked. We've been attacked. This is a defensive war. And when that didn't work, he goes into the Pacific, he provokes the Japanese, he imposes an oil embargo for the specific purpose of having the Japanese attack us so that he can say, this is a defensive war, we don't have a choice now, they've attacked at Pearl Harbor, give me my declaration of war, which, yes, at that point was a democratic decision, but I would argue not a truly legitimate one, since it was Roosevelt that provoked the attack in the first place.
Yeah, but Jacob, the Nazis would have taken over the whole world.
Yeah, that's the argument that's always used. I find it kind of interesting because there's certainly no evidence of that. The Nazis certainly could not even conquer England. They could not cross the English Channel with their forces to conquer England. And the the Germans were always interested in moving east toward the Soviet Union. I mean, they had acquired the Soviet Union as an enemy long before the United States did in the Cold War. So that's the real irony here, is that the U.S. and Nazi Germany end up with the same official enemy, the Soviet Union. And we end up with the Soviet Union winning the war. I mean, they were the true winners of the war. They got all of Eastern Europe, half of Germany. And yet we survive in a war, in a world with the Soviet Union there, promising to bury us and all this. And yet, we coexist. I always make the argument, the same thing would have happened with Germany. There would have been a dictatorship over there, just like there was a dictatorship in the Soviet Union. That doesn't necessarily mean that one nation is going to end up conquering and invading and occupying another nation.
Yeah. Now, it always seemed to me that if like in Pat Buchanan's argument, if the British, and in fact at FDR's urging too, hadn't turned Hitler west against themselves first, and the Nazis had invaded the Soviet Union earlier on and not given, Stalin 2 years longer to arm up after they had divvied up Poland, that surely would have led to war one way or the other between the two totalitarian powers. And then in that case, the Nazis would have had, it seems to me, I'm just making up stuff, counterfactual kind of thing, but it seems like the Nazis, since they almost succeeded, they would have had a much better chance of actually succeeding in destroying the Soviet Union. But then nobody can actually, no foreign power can actually occupy Russia for the long term anyway. So it seems to me like the Nazi empire by then would have been so overextended that I wouldn't have expected it to last anyway, or certainly not to outlast Hitler's lifespan.
Yeah, I agree with you that, there's this common conception that war and conquest and occupations of foreign lands make a nation stronger. Actually, it's the exact opposite. It weakens a nation. I mean, we see that weakening the United States today, where we have this overextended empire all across the world. We got out of control spending and debt, inflation around the corner. And the same thing would have happened with Germany.
Russia's cold.
Yeah.
It's really cold.
Really cold. And to maintain supply lines that long, it would have been extraordinary. But let's face it, even if it had been the case where Germany stays in the Soviet Union, what does that matter? That doesn't make them stronger. It doesn't mean that all of a sudden they're going to cross the oceans. I mean, people forget how enormously difficult it is to cross the Atlantic or Pacific Ocean with sufficient military force to invade, conquer, and occupy the United States of America. It's virtually impossible. You need hundreds of thousands of ships, millions of troops, airplanes, and everything. Germany never certainly never had that. The Soviet Union never had it. The Chinese never had it. And they still don't have it today.
All right, hold it right there.
There's absolutely no danger of that.
All right, hold it right there. When we come back, we're going to talk about saving democracy from totalitarianism, though, in the war. Right? It's Jacob Hornberger, FFF.org. Democracy. That's what Obama said this morning in his speech. You're fighting for democracy. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Jacob Hornberger. It's Memorial Day, so we're trashing American participation in World War II. The Holy War. The Good War. The Best War. And I got to get back to this because I'd like you to address it more ways if you could, however you can, Jacob. We're talking about the Nazis here, man. Is there never a time? And the Imperial Japanese, they were the Nazis of China. You know, they're freaking horrible. These guys are meaner than anybody since Tamerlane. They murder men, women, little bitty babies, you know, Gestapo rounding up people in the center of town and machine gunning them to death all damn day long. Is there never a time when Americans who we at least like think are better than that might just go ahead and bring violence to somebody like the Nazi regime and put an end to their existence and consequences be damned? They got to be stopped and then we'll worry about what happens after that. No?
Well, the problem is that whenever the government does that, the results are always worse afterward. I mean, we end up getting rid of Nazi Germany, but guess who controls Poland, Eastern Europe, half of Germany? The Soviet communists. And then we get this huge Cold War with ever-increasing military budgets and then the war in Korea and Vietnam and then the war on terrorism. So, you know, just because you get rid of one bad thing doesn't mean that you're going to end up with a good situation. You always end up with a worse situation. And I like the vision of our founding fathers. They said, look, America recognizes that there's a lot of bad things in the world. There's dictatorships, there's famine, there's tyranny, there's horror all around the world. But that this government, and this was expressed by John Quincy Adams in his 4th of July address to Congress in 1821, he says, this government, the American government, is not going to go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. That instead we're going to build a model society of freedom here at home, but we're going to have open immigration. So that if people are suffering tyranny, oppression, like in Nazi Germany, the Jews, etc., they have a place to come to, no questions asked. Now, what happened was the exact opposite. When Hitler offered to let the Jews out in the 1930s, the U.S. government said no. This was under the Franklin Roosevelt administration. They said, now we have immigration controls, we have immigration quotas, so no, we will not let the Jews from Germany come to the United States. So they've perverted our values. They've turned them upside down. They want to isolate the American people, the private sector, with embargoes and sanctions and so forth, and they want to unleash the national security establishment with bombs and missiles and assassinations and torture on the people of the world. That, I think our founders had it right.
So tell me this. How come after World War I they were able to more or less, I think, so the story goes, dismantle the military-industrial complex and turn the weapons factories back into
tractor factories and, you know, for productive use. And how come after World War II, no dice? They had to stay. They had to just keep finding enemies and build their nuclear arsenal and, you know, threaten all of mankind with extinction with their madness and all their welfare collection that they've done this whole time. What was it about World War II? Just the size?
That is an absolutely fascinating question. I wish every single American would ask that question and then reflect on it. Because the tradition was that there was always this antipathy towards standing armies in American history. I mean, if you go back to the Founding Fathers, we've got quotes by the Founding Fathers on our website at fff.org. Just type in standing armies FFF and you'll see them. I mean, they hated standing armies. They understood that big standing armies are a threat to your society, to the freedom and well-being of your society. So whenever there was a war, there was a dismantling of the standing army, the wartime army, after the war was over, because Americans understood we don't want this way of life in America. If it's necessary for war, fine, but once the war is over, everybody goes back into the private sector, or most everyone. That was the case with World War I as well, as you point out. In World War II, the militarists, the Americans that wanted a military way of life in the United States, realized that this was their opportunity to have a permanent military establishment, just like the Soviet Union, just like the totalitarian countries that we were opposing. In fact, the little known fact is they started building the Pentagon, the largest building in the world, even before we got involved in World War I, even before World War II, before Pearl Harbor. So as World War II is winding down, the military establishment, the OSS, the intelligence element in the government, said, we don't want to dismantle. And so they come up with the Cold War. They start provoking and antagonizing and insulting their allies in World War II, the Soviet communists. And they order them to vacate Eastern Europe when they had turned over Eastern Europe to the communists as part of the deal at Yalta and Tehran and the other conference that they had had. So now they had the perfect opportunity to say, we have to change America's way of life here in a very dramatic way, a very fundamental way. Big standing military establishment, military industrial complex, CIA, later the NSA. And Eisenhower pointed this out in his farewell address several years later. And he had been the commander of all Allied forces in World War II. And as he's leaving the presidency, he says, this way of life is totally new to the American experience, this military-industrial complex, and of course he was referring to the CIA as well. He says, this is not part of America's structure, and make no mistake about it, he said, this is a grave threat to our liberties and democratic processes, and of course it is.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, too, for Americans, they're just never exposed to anything like a body count of how many people their government has killed since World War II. And it is in the millions and millions. Just of Iraqis, it's at least a couple of million in the last 20, or especially if you go back 30 years to Jimmy Carter hiring Saddam to invade Iran back then. But and all the Kurds that Ronald Reagan paid him to kill and all of this and that, I mean, it adds up big time. People just don't want to confront that whatsoever, that, you know, our flags are a different color than the German Nazis' flags, but, and, you know, it's not really Nazism, but it is fascism, and it is, and what do you call, you know, mercantilism at war, at permanent war? It's a fascist empire. It's exactly what we claim we were trying to kill.
Yeah, it's a fascinating phenomenon, this glorification of the militarism. In fact, I want to recommend a great book that I just finished reading. I mean, this is a fantastic book on World War II and the aftermath. It's called The Good War That Wasn't by a guy named Ted Grimsrud. It really puts everything we're talking about in a nice, easy to read synopsis of what was going on with World War II and the aftermath. And he talks about this militarism as part of our culture now. There's this glorification of the military. It's a cancer and it's been a fantastic propaganda and indoctrination campaign by the national security establishment. It starts in the first grade, where children are inculcated with this notion that the military, the soldiers, are doing great things, you know, a force for good in the world. And so people don't, they lose this ability to critically think, to analyze, to say, hey, wait a minute. The United States invaded Iraq, a country that had never attacked the United States. And they glorified it and said, look, man, these are good soldiers that are killing people that are resisting their invasion. And the whole idea of you don't invade countries that don't attack you. This is wrong. This is what other totalitarian nations do. That has just been wiped out. There's been this perversion of American values, of American principles, that Americans don't do these kind of things, torture, regime change operations, assassinations. Now everything is praise the troops, just, you know, in one breath it's praise the Lord, and the other breath is praise the troops.
Yeah.
And it's really perverted our values and our principles, Scott.
Yeah, man, it's the most cynical thing. I mean, in Democrat years too, but especially under George W. Bush, where he just basically demanded that the entire right half of all of American political life line up behind him to defend torture. And a bunch of people who had never been in such a position to defend torture before said, yeah, you're damn right, you wimpy Democrats, torture's great, and all this, and just, you know, corrupted the hell out of tens of millions of people by demanding that they line up, otherwise you're Michael Moore. You know, big fat communist hypocrite, coward. And so, you know, it worked. It worked. And, you know, you can't calculate the degree of corruption of the, you know, whatever so-called collective psyche of the people of this society. It changed who, quote unquote, we are. And I mean, we in a way much more literal than when people say that referring to the government. But I mean, our society became just, at the very least, people don't care about it. They take it as a given.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, as Americans, we're supposed to stand for something bigger, something better, something more noble. And they perverted it all with this torture, rendition, invasions, assassinations. They've turned it all upside down.
And now get this, you're not even going to believe me, although, yeah, you will, but it's shocking enough. President Obama marks first Memorial Day in 14 years without a major U.S. war. Right. We still got troops in Afghanistan. We got troops in Iraq. We got air wars in Iraq, fighting on both sides in Yemen, still drone bombing Syria, supporting the fascists, no longer supporting the Mujahideen in Libya. We're now switching back to the fascist military, dictator, Gaddafi style dictatorship there, still supporting the Mujahideen against Assad in Syria. While we're supporting the Iraqis against the Mujahideen in Iraq, but not that there are any wars on or anything like that. We're training the Ukrainians so they can go back to war with Russian-backed rebels in eastern Ukraine. But thank goodness it's now the return to normalcy. According to Barack Obama, we can celebrate this Memorial Day at peace. Jacob, what do you think?
Well, the people on whom the bombs are falling, they would probably disagree. And the assassination attempts and the drones and so forth. That maybe he defines war as that if American soldiers aren't getting killed, it's not war. If all they're doing is killing people with the drone assassinations, the bombs that are dropping in Iraq, that maybe that they consider that's not a real war when foreigners are dying. But it's killing nonetheless. I mean, and it's getting people increasingly angry at the United States. So you have this constant threat of a terrorist attack out of retaliation, which means they got to take away our freedoms. They need the secret surveillance schemes. They need the NSA and so forth. And increasingly infringements on our privacy and liberties. You know, what we're trying to do, Scott, I mean, really the libertarians are the light out of this darkness. Is all you've got to do is come to the realization that you don't need this huge Pentagon, military establishment, CIA, NSA, to keep the nation secure. That, in fact, they are the root of the insecurity. That if you dismantle this thing, you've actually got a more powerful nation. Because history has shown that when you've got a weak government, you have a powerful nation. When you have an overarching, powerful government, you have a weak nation because you end up with weak citizens.
That is Jacob Hornberger. He is the founder and the president of the Future of Freedom Foundation. They're at fff.org. Thanks very much for your time on the show, Jacob. Good to talk to you again, as always.
It's always an honor to be with you, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. And we'll be right back, y'all. Gareth Porter coming up.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, you guys. So Gareth is coming up to talk about Syria with us. Syria and Iraq and the whole damn war over there. You know, one thing I was going to ask Jacob, but then... Oh, I kept him into the break there for a couple of minutes recording. One of the things I was going to ask him, but then he said something better and off topic that... It would have been going back down to a smaller letter on the outline, so to speak, to get back to this, I guess. So I just let it go. But I wonder what you guys think. You could tweet me about it. I'm not really set up taking phone calls right now, and I got too much other crap I want to complain about. So, but tell me in the chat room, guys, if you want to, or tell me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show there. That's also the chat room is hashtag Scott Horton Show, IRC free note thing, scotthorton.org/chat. Is it peacetime right now? You guys didn't hear the part. So Obama, and I missed this too, I only saw like the second half of the speech or something. But Obama made a big deal claiming that this is the first Memorial Day in 14 years without a major U.S. war. The Afghan war is over. It's actually not over. I mean, many of the troops have been pulled out, that's true, but it's not over. They're staying. Got another article right here about how they say they're staying, too. Top U.S. General, troops to stay in Afghanistan, by Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com, there. But anyway, we're at war in Afghanistan, Pakistan, on both sides in Yemen, fighting for and against Al-Qaeda. Fighting against them in Somalia. Used to be fighting for them. Now we're fighting against them in Libya. Fighting against them in Mali. Fighting for them still in Syria while we help the Iranians fight against them in Iraq. But at least we're not at war. Is it really peacetime? Is it not wartime in America unless it's the early days of the invasion of Iraq against the Saddam Hussein army? And then after that, it's like might as well be, you know, as peacetime as the 90s anyway, even though Bill Clinton was bombing Iraq on average of every other day for 8 years straight. Is it peacetime right now? Like the kids at school and the people at the office and the people in the neighborhood, do they consider right now to be peacetime? You know, like I was a kid in the Reagan years. It was basically peacetime. There was a lot of threatening going on, but nobody nuked each other. And yeah, they were paying people to hack people to death with machetes down in Central America and that kind of thing. But nothing compared to this, right? But, you know, I'm asking about the secondary quality here, you know. I'm interested in what it is that you think people think. What's their impression? The Barack Obama years, are they basically equivalent to the Clinton years? Now, during Bush, we were at war, but right now, hey, at least there's no major wars going on. According to Barack Obama. I don't know. Let me know what you think of that, guys. Here, I'll look at the chat room now and see what your answers are. Only not a major war because no advisors have been killed. I pray they won't because they'll start World War III. Yeah, well, I'm not sure what UA means, sorry. Well, I don't know, man. That's strange, though. I wonder, I should go do a man on the street interview kind of thing. You guys consider it peacetime or wartime right now? That's a pretty simple question, right? It's funny because I think, man, the poor kids today, they've grown up their whole lives during wartime. And then, well, geez, I don't know. Is that really even true? That's not just raising the question. That's begging the question. Maybe it is peacetime to them. It's perfectly fine as far as they're concerned. Anyway, I'm sorry I'm wasting a whole damn segment on this. But the cops killed an Austinite, a lady. They shot her dead. It was an officer-involved shooting. Now, you guessed. Does that mean that the lady shot a cop? Or does that mean that the cop shot the lady? That's right. The cop shot the lady. Now, they won't just say, cop shoots lady dead. They have to put it in passive voice. Woman dead in officer-involved shooting. Now, of course, you can see right through it. You know what it means. The cop killed her. With a gun and a bullet, at least, maybe more than one. A cop shot a lady and killed her. And you know what? I'm glad that they use this very base level, ridiculous manipulation. Because don't you see right through it? And doesn't it make you angry? At no other time does anybody kill anybody. And it's written up in the paper that someone got killed by a bullet that came out of a gun somehow in a thing that another person was involved in also. What? The one guy shot the other guy. Maybe they'll give you an allegedly. Woman dies of bullets shot at her by a cop. A woman dead in officer-involved shooting. You know what it is? They say that she was a suicidal person. I don't know about that. In fact, they don't say that at KI. That was the Austin American Statesman. At KI TV, that's the CBS guys, right? Yeah. The CBS guys, they don't say that. They say she had locked herself in an apartment with a gun. But even assuming the truth of that, that doesn't necessarily imply that she was threatening to kill herself. But even if she was, it says here she was having an argument with her boyfriend. So maybe she was threatening suicide. So then what does the APD do? They come and they kill her. And it's pretty easy to guess what happened. They said to her, drop the gun. And then they killed her. She wasn't pointing it at them. She didn't threaten to kill them. Don't lie to me. Don't even try to tell me that this, you know, lady having a problem was posing a direct and imminent threat to the lives of these officers. She had a gun, and so, say it with me now, they could kill her. And so they did. You know, I even had that thing. They ran it, I think it was at Vox, where they had a quote of these cops, pretty sure it was at Vox. Man, I should have saved this footnote. I'll find it for you. Maybe you guys in the chat room can find it. Where I think it was a cop from Albuquerque, New Mexico, was explaining that, yeah, it got to where you shoot someone if you can. If you think you're past the technical threshold for being allowed to kill someone, you kill them. You take the opportunity to kill them. And he admitted it, exactly like I've been accusing them all this time. They're looking for a chance to kill somebody, and out of the cop's mouth himself. So they come in, someone is throwing a temper tantrum, more or less, for whatever reason. That's what we're talking about. People throwing a temper tantrum. And the cop's saying, well, they have a weapon in their hand, so I have the right. I know that I can get away with killing them, shooting them to death. In a way that would be murder if anyone else did it. If anyone else did it, if the roommate did it, they'd charge the roommate with murder. Well, she had a knife. She wouldn't drop it. I told her to drop the knife. She wouldn't drop the knife, so I shot her. Well, but she was hiding in the corner, and she wasn't coming at you. Doesn't matter if you're a cop, but if you're a regular person, you go to prison for that. Direct and proportional and imminent. These are all things that come into play, whatever, when it's regular people. When it's a cop, they can kill whoever they want, basically. And in fact, they don't have to even have a weapon, right? The person doesn't have to have a weapon. All they have to do is say, well, he was reaching for his waistband. It looked to me like he had something in his waistband. Waistband!
That's it. And, you know, it was the Washington Post, as official journalism as it gets, and they did a very in-depth study, and they showed where there had been 5,000 people killed by cops in the last 10 years, since 2005. There have been 5,000 people killed. And it was more than that. God, it had to have been more than that. But still, and there had been, what, 24 were even charged, one convicted. One. Anyway, this lady threatened to kill herself, so they killed her. My security force. My protectors. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the goddamn thing here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Gareth coming up in just a few minutes to talk about the madness going on in Syria here. In the war against the Islamic State. I really shouldn't call it Iraq War 3 because, about half the Islamic State is in Syria, right? Well, a third of it or something. What used to be Syria. It's amazing just what the Americans destroy when they put their minds to it, you know? What they can create. This is Michael Ledeen's Boiling Cauldron, his creative destruction, if you will. Yeah, what we'll do, we'll destroy Arab secular nationalist fascism, and we'll replace it with outright bin Ladenite head-chopping suicide bomber freaking lunatics. This is a great idea. I read it in the National Review. We know just what to do. Right, guys? All us neocons, the National Review and Weekly Standard, we all held a conference, and we all agree that we're right. And the AEI says so, too. Everyone that on a piece of paper in Bill Kristol's desk drawer all agree. All right. Hey, here's some good news, man. Let me talk about this for a little bit. Every day is Memorial Day here on the Scott Horton Show. But Medea Benjamin and them, and I don't know who all them is, you know, a bunch of lefty peacenik ladies, I guess. I don't know how they swung this. They got permission, and they did a big march from South Korea into North Korea, demanding a formal peace and an end to the simple ceasefire agreement that has left North and South Korea technically in a permanent state of war since the 1950s. And in the picture that I saw, Benjamin's sign says, reunite Korea, or something along those lines. And I'm all for that. I got no problem with that. But for God's sake, end the Cold War. If you can normalize relations with, you know, I don't know. What are the relationships with Zimbabwe these days? I don't know anymore. But if you can have a normal relationship with the dictatorship in XYZ, then why not Korea? America backs every king and sultan and Emir and El Presidente on the planet. All of them. So why not have normalized relations with North Korea? And what better means, what better idea does anyone have for helping the people of North Korea? That they may work and save up capital and reinvest it in improving their lives. How else are you going to do that? How are you going to, you know, shatter the ice of communism that's holding their society still? How are you going to free them? Look at China. What if they'd insisted on full Cold War until the Politburo in China abdicates? We'd still be a Cold War with Communist China right now. Instead, we got Capitalist China. Well, it's sort of Fascist China. But it's a better standard of living than they've ever had in a long, long time. And that goes for just about everybody. Although, obviously, it's harder for some to catch up than others. But, hell, compared to everybody laying down, starving to death in the dirt equally, I think it's an improvement over actual communism, wouldn't you say? So why can't we have a China policy toward North Korea? It's crazy, man. And think about this. If a war ever breaks out there, you got 35,000 American soldiers there that could be in real danger. Because the one thing that the North has, a hell of a lot of artillery. And I mean a hell of a lot. And they've buried it under a lot of concrete. A hell of a lot of concrete. And Seoul, the capital city, is within range. And much of America's military bases, which I'm not sure all the positions, I'm sure they move them around. In fact, I know they've moved them around. But there are certainly a lot of American soldiers and Marines and sailors and who knows who else, airmen too, as well as the civilian population of Seoul at terrible risk of, you know, an onslaught of artillery that, you know, probably people have never seen. Just as far as how many available tubes and shells they have prepared when the day ever comes. At least that's the mythology. I don't know. Not mythology, but I think I know that from reading things back when. So war should be unthinkable because what could happen to our side, right? Never mind if Curtis LeMay burns their entire society to the ground again. But some of the good guys could get hurt, everybody. So we better just not have a war. So, I like them Code Pink ladies. I mean, in a way, I think it's problematic that pink is the color of socialism and of femininity, which in a way excludes a lot of people who would like to agree. It makes it kind of too exclusive of a club. But on the other hand, they get a hell of a lot of work done. A lot more than me. And they do heroic things like this, like marching across the DMZ into North Korea demanding peace and freedom. Or at least peace, which is good enough for now. Anyway, so that's what I think. Don't you think it's crazy? I mean, look, if it was still 1992 and everyone in D.C. agrees that the North Korean regime is going to fall any day now, okay, but it's been ready to fall any day now for 25 years, so let's go ahead and forget that and go ahead and give them a Cuba policy. Why the hell not? Yeah. Anyway, that's what I think. All right, you know, let's see, what else? Oh, yeah, I had Iraq and Syria, all that I'm saving for the Gareth Porter interview. So let's see. Israel, Palestine. Oh yeah. Here, let me just mention real quick. This is fun to read. Sheesh, a conservative response to the special relationship. That's at Mondo Weiss. And it's about how America's going to bribe the Israelis on the Iran nuclear deal by giving them a bunch of F-35s. Ha ha. Wah, wah, wah. The F-35 is complete piece crap, dude. So, I don't know if that's Barack Obama deliberately tweaking their nose, or if the Israeli government is just completely ridiculously stupid. I mean, I guess they're not going to have to worry too much about flying it in the rain, right, out there in the desert, but yeah, you can't fly F-35 anywhere near the rain. Then again, you can't get the fuel warm either in storage before filling the plane up with it. It's very volatile. What a lemon. What a great bribe. Oh, and then, so check it out. It looks like, I don't understand all the details well enough to recite them to you, but it looks like Rand Paul has successfully helped to kill Section 215 of the Patriot Act. It's not completely dead yet, but it looks like it's going to be. So check out the news at antiwar.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C., but those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome to the show. Back to it, I mean to say. All right, next up, it's our friend Gareth Porter. Writing for Middle East Eye nowadays, mostly. Also, truthout.org. MiddleEastEye.net. Oh, he wrote the book, Manufactured Crisis. Everything in the world relevant you need to know about Iran's nuclear program and how it ain't scary. Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter. Okay, and now this article is Obama's failure on Saudi-Qatari aid to Al-Qaeda affiliate. That would be the Al-Nusra Front there in Syria. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Gareth?
Hi, Scott. Glad to be back. Thanks.
Good. Happy to have you here. So, now here's the thing. I think mostly because you were writing that book, you have not done a whole lot of coverage on the Syria beat since the 2011 Arab Spring. I mean, hey, there's been an Afghan surge and all kinds of problems going on all over the place that you've been working on as well, I know. It's very interesting to me. I'd be very interested to hear what all you think about all of this. You're obviously in this article covering a very current day stuff, but there's a hell of an American policy going on here in Syria. We've had a lot of fun trying to unravel, and you know, over the last few years here on the show, and got some new evidence out about just what Nixon knew and when he knew it too. So, first of all, tell us about Obama's meeting here with the GCC that you wrote this article about.
Right. So this story is really about how Obama has privileged his sort of political protection of the Iran agreement from being attacked by the Saudis and their allies in the Gulf, the GCC organization of Gulf Sheikhdoms. And privilege that over the interests of the United States regarding the Saudi policy, the Saudi-Qatari policy jointly in Syria of supporting the Al-Qaeda affiliates there, basically. I mean, this is an astonishing turn of events, not astonishing, but certainly shocking turn of events that obviously should get much more attention than it has. And in fact, I'm not at all sure that any mainstream media has touched on this. Maybe you've seen something, but I haven't up to now.
Well, what's so shocking about it? I mean, if it's shocking, it's that even a year after the creation of the Islamic State, the declaration of the caliphate, they still haven't changed their policy from the high treason they've been engaged in since 2011 here.
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm suggesting here is that the, when this has come to such a an open sort of public matter of, a meeting with the Saudis under circumstances where, it's public knowledge that the Saudis and the Qataris have helped create this new front, this new command in Syria, which essentially involves 90% of the troops, according to this royal family source who I was able to make contact with for this story. The troops under this command, 90% are Jabhat al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham troops. And then there's a tiny smattering of so-called moderates or Free Syrian Army type troops. And so this is all public information. And furthermore, everybody knows that, certainly the administration knows that this new army command, the army of conquest, was instrumental in bringing about the largest, victory for jihadist forces in the Syrian war since 2013, since the capture of al-Raqqa. This is the capture of Idlib provincial capital in late March. This is part of an obvious crisis situation in Syria. And here we have a meeting of Obama, a summit meeting of Obama and the GCC countries in Camp David. And we see Obama basically instead of making this a major issue and putting heavy pressure on the Saudis, using the obvious means at his disposal to do so, including leaking this to the news media ahead of time, you know, he basically downplays this and agrees to relegate the subject, the whole subject of the Saudi support for the jihadists, for the al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, to an annex to the joint statement, not to the joint statement itself. And so basically the Saudis appear to be getting off scot-free. I see no reason to believe, no evidence that the Saudis have changed their policy. They're continuing the policy. This was the this was what I got from the royal family source in Saudi Arabia. And so what we see is Obama basically saying, we'll make a deal. I'll remain quiet about what you're doing in Syria in return for your sort of turning down the volume or not basically attacking my policy of negotiating an agreement with Iran.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I understand what you're saying, but
that's shocking. I mean,
what's the evidence that Obama and the Saudis don't see completely eye to eye on this, just like they have the whole time? I mean, America and Israel and Turkey and Saudi and Qatar have been working all along. I got even David Sanger in the New York Times in 2012 saying, well, all the guns are going to al-Nusra. They dominate the field and they cut people's heads off. And in fact, hey, look, the FSA cuts people's heads off too. And they're all a bunch of suicide bomber, bin Ladenite lunatics. Their leaders are all veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq, where they fought against our guys in Iraq War II. And what in the hell is this? And I haven't seen any evidence that Obama ever told them to knock it off. It sounds to me like it's his policy, and if anything, they're just providing the not very plausible deniability for it. What about that?
Well, I think there's a distinction here, as I document in the same article that we're just discussing now, my recent article, that last November the Obama administration did in fact make it clear. They were leaking to David Ignatius that they'd been extremely unhappy about what the Saudis were doing, and you know, this was just another stage in the saga of the Obama administration dealing with this issue. I agree that they did not do enough, but you know, I think the distinction here is that before, they were not able to say that the Saudis were directly supporting al-Nusra Front. I mean, you know, they were saying that the arms have ended up in the hands of al-Nusra Front. But the Saudis were saying, you know, that was not our intention. We were supporting other people, and those people quit and joined the al-Nusra Front. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that was, I mean, you know, I don't know what actually happened, but that was the narrative that was being discussed. So now it's a different narrative. It's a much more direct, much more dramatic narrative, where the Saudis are making no bones about the fact that they're supporting al-Nusra Front, and the Obama administration, of course, does not formally accept that, but it's clear that they're not doing anything about it. Right. So,
and the Turks too. The Turks are openly bragging about how they coordinated the sacking of Idlib.
Right. Absolutely. And so, I mean, and I think this takes us back to, you know, trying to analyze what the nature of the Obama administration policy is in Syria and elsewhere. But looking at Syria, you know, you have to analyze this, it seems to me, as I've said all along, in terms of a White House political interest. It has nothing to do with national interest or national security.
I thought you were going to say from an Israeli point of view, but that's the same thing. All right, hang on just one second. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show.
I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I got Gareth Porter on the line. We're talking about America's policy towards Syria here and toward the Gulf Cooperation Council, which means Saudi and the Gulf state allies. And then, of course, the Israelis and the Turks, they have their role in it as well. And how Obama is basically telling the Saudis and the Qataris, go ahead and back al-Nusra. Don't even pretend you're back in, Arar al-Sham, and then somehow the weapons are ending up in the hands of al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, loyal to Zawahiri. But they go ahead, openly admit it, and he basically goes ahead and gives them open permission. Just don't screw up my Iran nuclear deal, he says, and you can go ahead and continue to do this. And so I want to apologize a little bit for using the term high treason earlier and saying it like that, because it sounds like hyperbole and it sounds kind of discrediting to the whole conversation, as though, you know, this is just some ideological agenda or something like that. And yet the only reason I say that is because I'm pretty sure that technically Barack Obama is guilty of high treason. And if what George Bush accidentally did for Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri was horrible, Obama did the same thing for Osama and Ayman al-Zawahiri deliberately in Libya and in Syria, both backing their movements, not just giving them a lawless territory to rule and war in for a few years like Bush Jr., but actually has taken their side. And to this day, the legions of Ayman al-Zawahiri, the butcher of New York. So why should he not be in the Supermax next to Ted Kaczynski? Or what are we talking about here? This is just foreign policy, Gareth, or what?
Well, I mean, you know, I think I nuance this a bit more than you've done there in that statement.
by
just pointing out to the necessity to make distinctions, first of all, between what we know happened on Syria before with regard to the Saudi policy and what we know now. I mean, I think that the present, the situation that has emerged in the last several weeks since late March or, you know, before that, but, you know, when with the Army of Conquest and the more or less open Saudi support for it. I wouldn't say more or less. I would say open Saudi support for it. This is a new stage. This is a much more clear-cut case that Obama is not acting to defend the national security interests of the United States, but acting against it. I think that one would have to say that in the past that it was a terrible policy, but to say that it was an overt act of treason or, you know, that he was deliberately, you know, sabotaging U.S. national security in regard to, the Saudi policy there is, that's
well,
not.
I would put it that way. I mean, I would say he thinks he's smart, not that he's actually exchanged his loyalty because he's a Kenyan secret Muslim kind of thing, but he's
just, I know.
You know, he thinks he's clever, but so listen, I want to play this clip real quick. It's a short one. But it's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, I know you're familiar with the clip, defending herself from the question of why are we not doing more to support the rebellion in Syria. And this is now, this is from very early March, maybe late February of 2012. So more than 3 years ago now. And she answers, defending the administration's position.
We know al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria?
All right. And so now we know what she means. She's not saying, are we directly giving guns to guys that we know love Zawahiri more than us? That's not what she's saying. She's saying, are we, you know, helping these guys in essence? Are we de facto their allies and taking their side in the war? We have to be very careful about who it is we're backing. Right. And then the entire administration, including her, continued to do that, and she apparently had the most hawkish position of all of them, saying that we ought to keep doing exactly that. And I know they claimed under the theory that they were supporting this so-called moderate army to marginalize the extremists, but we all know that moderate army never existed and was impossible for them to create in a way that it was going to be able to take on Nusra, ISIS, and Assad, Hezbollah, and everybody else in there. The whole thing, as the president himself said, was a fantasy, but they kept doing it anyway this whole time.
Well, yeah, I mean, and of course, I agree with you that the old idea of a moderate army was, you know, nothing short of a scandalous fiction. You know, it never really amounted to anything. And in fact, I mean, you can find statements. I remember distinctly a statement by Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, indicating the same thing, that there is nobody to support. There's nobody for us to support in Syria, was his point. And so, I mean, there was a widespread understanding of that. And again, I mean, you know, I want to bring the conversation back to, you know, trying to understand what is it that leads the White House to make certain statements, to take certain positions on Syria that don't make any sense. And I mean, I think that, you know, you have to see it fundamentally as a kind of political triangulation exercise that constantly goes on. You know, we have a president who clearly does understand that he was being pushed by people in his administration to take positions that he knew were crazy and wrong. And, you know, there's some indication that he has, in fact, resisted that pressure. To a great extent. And so, you know, it's in that context that I'm suggesting that what he's doing is just constantly, it's domestic politics is defining almost entirely the White House position, which is U.S. foreign policy. I mean, that is pretty much, at this point, what U.S. foreign policy is. It's what the White House is declaring or failing to declare. Well, you know, it's, and so this brings us back to this whole problem that U.S. foreign policy is never based on the reality on the ground. It's not a response to the reality on the ground. It is a response to either domestic, electoral, personal White House politics or bureaucratic interests. And here I'm suggesting that, you know, the primary explanation here is this personal White House political interest. Just, you know, just like his maneuvering over the whole bin Laden issue is all, you know, just merely about positioning himself politically. Mm-hmm. You know, I just think that that's really the answer to the question. Why is he doing or not doing what he's doing and not doing on Syria?
All right, so now, what did you learn from this new DIA report?
Well, I mean, I think that the DIA was, in fact, calling it right, that they saw that what was happening was that there was a gathering jihadist movement made up of Jabhat al-Nusra and other al-Qaeda fronts there.
This is before ISIS split off. Yeah, this was back in 2012.
Right. This is 2012. And, you know, he was the DIA analysts were making it clear that this was, in fact, going to be leading to a likelihood of that they were going to dominate the war, that they were going to become the most powerful factor in the war.
And that it would destroy Iraq.
Yeah, and that was going to affect exactly that. It was going to affect the ability to respond to threats to security in Iraq. Exactly, they understood the strategic linkage between the two.
I mean, and they even say, you know, they're going to roll right back into Mosul and Ramadi and declare an Islamic state. I mean, it sounds like, you know, an interview of Patrick Coburn on this show circa the same day that this thing was written.
So, I mean, to me, it underlines the ability of intelligence analysts to get it right, to be very precise in their analysis when they do so without the intervening filter of higher level, higher level intelligence officials who are motivated, of course, by politics, by their desire to, you know, curry favor with policymakers and people in the White House. And you know, this is a very good example of just how good they can be in that regard and how, you know, what we actually, I think, see for the most part, happening is that when there is a national intelligence estimate, this process is extremely political, and it results in the very good analysis that we see in this specific DIA report, watered down, changed, corrupted into something that's much closer to supporting the policy.
Yeah. Well, remember Vladimir Putin called John Kerry a liar when John Kerry said, oh, no, the rebels, they're all a bunch of moderate secularists and stuff. They all want a bunch of elections. And Putin was like, what are you talking about? I can't believe the nerve. And, you know, not to take his side, but, boy, against John Kerry, it's easy, I'll tell you.
And again, you know, all this is happening, Scott, in a country that is, okay, let's say the second most right-wing country in the world. And we all know what the most right-wing country in the world is.
Everything
that happens in national security policy and foreign policy is tilted, corrupted, shifted very far towards the most outrageous outcomes by that political fact, because the right wing is so powerful in this country that they essentially not just exercise a veto power, but pressure, you know, automatically the White House in various ways, both, you know, sort of directly through their own declarations and so forth, and through the calculus that the White House is always going through politically.
Mm-hmm.
That's my take on it.
Well, no, I feel you. And, you know, Justin Raimondo basically has the exact same thing. He calls it libertarian realism, that all foreign policy is just domestic politics expressed and whatever. But the thing to me that's very interesting about this, and I'm keeping you over time now, I hope you don't mind. So I had Mark Perry on the show, and I guess this could just be CYA, you know, that kind of thing. But the generals are saying, why in the world are we flying as Al-Qaeda's Air Force in Yemen right now? You know, John McCain complains that we're flying as Iran's Air Force in Iraq, but he does say he wants us to fight the Islamic State, so whatever. But now we're fighting, you know, again, I guess he could have said. Here we are flying as Al-Qaeda's Air Force against the Houthis in Yemen. This policy's crazy. And so... Right. You know, what about that, you know, 10-foot tall power of the Pentagon to say, listen, Israel's great and the Turks and the Saudis have their interests, we understand, but we don't want to fight for Al-Qaeda anymore. Backing dictatorships is horrible enough, or maybe a lot of fun, I don't know, but backing Al-Qaeda revolutions, we don't want to do that anymore, sir. The Libya-Syria policy, we're done.
Very, very important issue. I think it needs to be analyzed, and I think it's you know, you have then to look at different interests within the Pentagon. I think you know Mark is in touch with sources who do tend to be anti-interventionist in Syria. They're obviously against any war with Iran and so on and so forth. There are other interests in the Pentagon and the CIA and the NSA who are very, very pro-Saudi, who are very close to the Saudis. And so I always emphasize this point, just to bear that in mind when you see, you know, somebody in the Pentagon making a statement such as the one that you're citing. I'm sure that's true, that there are people in the Pentagon who are very upset that, with the policy in Yemen. It doesn't make any sense. They know that the Houthis are the most effective counter terrorism, that is anti-Al-Qaeda force in Yemen, and the present policy is making it much more difficult for the Houthis to undertake any effective actions, because they're trying to fend off the Saudis and their allies, which may or may not include Al-Qaeda at this point. But I have to assume that, you know, there's at least some carryover to supporting Al-Qaeda in Yemen at this point by the Saudis.
All right, one more question. What do you think is going to happen with the destruction and the de-bothification of the Syrian government and the abolition of its army? In other words, what happens after the Saudis and the Turks and the Israelis and the Qataris and the Americans get their way in Syria?
Well, look,
then what?
At the very least, what we're seeing is the realization of this breakup of Iraq into three de facto states. I mean, I think that's clearly... the situation as it stands now, and there's no reason to believe that's going to change anytime soon.
Well, do you think the Baathist government in Damascus stands a chance against these guys at this point, or they're going to have direct access to the Mediterranean Sea, and they'll just be a real state from now on, the Islamic state?
What I heard when I was in Beirut this last time was that there is some talk about the possibility that Iran and Hezbollah would carve out some territory in Syria that would allow them to continue to supply Hezbollah in Lebanon, and that would be, you know, their way of dealing with the potential demise of the Assad regime. I don't know of how realistic that is, but there's some speculation about that.
All right. Well, thanks for coming back on the show, Garrett. It's always good to talk to you.
Thanks, Scott. Always glad to be back.
Appreciate it. All right, y'all. That's the great Gareth Porter, and I'm way over time for the show today. Bye.